how did you come across the idea of studying music history? We all think about, you know, piano lessons, maybe growing up, or violin. How did you, was there a natural love for you and music history?
Well, there's always a natural love with me and history, speaking generally. But the way I became a music historian was entirely serendipitous, unpredictable. It's just one of those ways our lives curve in directions we have no idea about. I got my PhD in music composition from the University of California, Berkeley, and I fell in love with the Bay Area. Having come out here from the East Coast in 78, I made a conscious decision not to leave, which meant that I didn't get involved in the academic box top trade of sending your stuff out all over the place and hoping to get a gig somewhere, somehow, but determined to stay in the Bay Area. And the kind of work I was able to find with a PhD in composition was zero. But there were lots of teaching gigs at extension programs and at small colleges and such for non-departmental music majors, music appreciation. And then there were lots of teaching gigs for adults at night in living rooms or at extension programs. And so I began doing that kind of teaching. And then I was asked to do ever more and more detailed courses, courses on Beethoven or Mahler or Bach and Mozart and so forth. And this is music that I knew intimately already, but as a composer, that is, as an analyst, as someone who tries to take a piece apart and understand what makes it work, I found it was equally fascinating to think about the life of a composer, the environment in which he or she lived, the way that environment and the styles and economies and, you know, the culture of the time shapes the style of a piece of music, because that's true. I mean, there's a reason why Bach's music doesn't sound like Beethoven. And if Beethoven had lived 100 years earlier, he could not have written the Ninth Symphony. He might have written something else of equal import, but he couldn't have written the Ninth Symphony as we know it, because it's the time that creates the stylistic environment. And this increasingly fascinated me, because you realize music, like everything else, is a full-body activity. It involves everything, not just sound. And the more context you had for a piece of music, vis-a-vis the environment, the culture, a composer's life, the more you actually heard in the piece itself, plus good analysis. And now suddenly you've revealed great truths about both the piece of music itself and how it becomes iconographic of the environment in which it was created. So that's how I became a music historian, by default, by necessity,
sure.
By the need to pay the bills and find work. And so when I finally did find academic work at the San Francisco Conservatory, it was as a professor of music history. I chaired the Department of History and Literature there for, 16 years. And that's what opened doors to things like the Teaching Company or the Great Courses, as it's now known. I've been recording courses for them for 20 years. That's what led to the book. That's what led to a lot of my speaking. And I still compose. Every other year I write music. And then every alternate year I make a course or write a book.
I think it's one of those neat things in this title that it says history, culture, and heart, that it's mm-hmm. not specifically a musicology sort of thing, and that these things are interrelated.
Everything's interrelated. You know, one of the beauties of being first a composer and not a professional musicologist, that is, a professional music historian, is that I can be a total generalist. I can go places that in academia might be frowned upon. I can make statements that are true, but are the kind of statements that a professional would shy away from because they're seen as being too general, and if you can't qualify them, you shouldn't make those statements. I have no such limitations. I want my readers and I want my listeners to be able to hear what I hear, to be able to perceive what I perceive, and to get the same charge out of it that I get. And that's basically what's behind everything I do as a teacher of music. I want to create a complete context for a piece. I want us to understand the composer. I want us to understand the environment. And then I want us to understand the piece of music as both representing the composer and the environment, and then as a piece of art unto itself. And I can do that because I have no political restraints placed on me.
This isn't a something meant for Journal of American Musicology, so what jams or whatever the heck, you know. This isn't
correct.
And
everything has its place in the world. Another thing I'm grateful about, I've done so much work with this great courses, this teaching company. I've recorded something like 650 45-minute lectures over the last 20 years for them. And the beauty of that company, for example, is that there's an assumption, and that assumption is there's a Western canon, that there is a quantifiable series of works, literary, historical, musical, visual art, and so forth, that form the backbone of their respective repertoires. And this is not something that is being pursued enthusiastically in academia right now, where in a desire to recognize all cultures, a worthy desire, but in a desire to recognize all cultures and all times, we have denied that there are certain qualitative differences between things. But the beauty of the work I do is I don't have to subscribe to any correctness whatsoever. There, frankly, are certain works of art that deserve to be celebrated and that we can continually learn from, no matter how often we deal with them. And there's a reason why we still go to Shakespeare plays. There's something intrinsically good about them. Good meaning we're willing to waste our time on them. And we learn things about ourselves through high-end art that we maybe don't learn about through other kinds of entertainments. So, you know, given what I do and given the kind of work I've done, I don't have to subscribe to this anti-canon mentality. I can go right to the dead Germans who I love so much and talk about them like they were with us today.
Are there any favorites out of this sort of canon that have come along, or are there any surprises along the way that you were like, oh, wow, you know, this was a tidbit or a kernel you wouldn't have expected?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously there's all kinds of biographical detail that you run into that allows you to identify ever more closely with these composers as people. And then there's even composers that I run into and I listen to and I say, wow, that's a revelation. I didn't know. I just recorded a course in January. I was back in Virginia where the studios are that deals with solo piano music. And one of the pieces that I lectured on is a piece called Iberia by Itzhak Albini. And Albini was a Spanish-born composer, Catalonian-born, who lived from about, I'm just saying this off the top of my head, from the 1860s to about 1915 or so. Well, I'd known of his stuff because as a piano student, I'd played some of his light piano music, but I'd never studied this Iberia, which consists of 12 impossibly difficult piano movements. Well, it was a revelation. I mean, here I am, 58, and I'm being just knocked on the floor and wiped around by the quality of this music from a compositional point of view, from a pianistic point of view, and then from a purely beauty point of view. And that's the kind of surprise I like best, because I can go wherever the repertoire leads me. I still discover pieces that I didn't know, even composers who I never appreciated. Liszt is another example, a composer that when we were students in the postmodernistic American university, I'm talking about for me the early 70s, Liszt was a word that you never even mentioned. He was nothing but a showman charlatan who had nothing to offer compositionally. That's so wrong. I can't even believe those people got away with saying that kind of thing. The man was an amazing composer. Okay. There were times when he was a little too enamored with his first ideas. But that's okay. Those composers who write a lot of music kind of intend you to throw some of it away. But Liszt at his best is as good as anyone, and I'm thrilled to have discovered that better late than never.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Greenberg, who has a wonderful book, How to Listen to Great Music, A Guide to Its History, Culture, and Heart. Is it written, do you think, that someone that is studying music, maybe a young person, will enjoy this, and maybe someone that just is maybe curious about music that might learn a little bit more and sort of peel back the layers of an onion?
I think that's exactly who the book is for. The book is not intended as a textbook, so it's not a comprehensive book. But it takes the music of the 300-year period, what's called the common practice, between about 1600 and 1900, and examines it through a number of different lenses. One, the historical environment in which the composer lived and what were the tastes of the time, what creates the sound of the music, that is its style. Two, who was the composer? Can we, in the brief amount of time I've gotten a book like this, can we cut through all that guano that's accumulated on their memories like seaside rocks? Can we kind of understand that this was a person? And to the degree we can, understand how that person's personality shapes the sound of the music, and three, select certain works as examples and then investigate them as works of art. I would hope, again, we all hope all sorts of things, right? I would hope that the book would be entertaining to all and would offer something to pretty much everybody.
I know it's a sort of Herculean task to sort of narrow down because there's so much. They keep on discovering, you know, another piece by Vivaldi that was hidden in some library or Bach that was, you know, around. But it had to be fun and at the same time probably a little bit of stress going, gosh, I really want to, you know, have this, you know, Bach B minor mass mentioned, or, you know, gosh, yeah. I need, you know. So I imagine that was probably a little bit of a fun and hard at the same time.
You know, it's always harder to write short than write long. I mean, there's that famous letter by Abe Lincoln, some long letter, and he apologizes at the end of it and says, you know, I would have made this letter shorter, but I didn't have enough time. And it's true. When you have to discipline yourself and really pick and choose, it's much harder than if you could just throw the kitchen sink at it. We had the project, as it was originally conceived, was one of the courses I did for the teaching company, for the great courses. It was a 48-lecture, How to Listen to and Understand Great Music. And that course runs about 260,000 words in its 48 lectures. So the publishing company, Plume, which is a division of Penguin, approached us meaning the teaching company and myself, and said, listen, can you turn this into a book? And I was thrilled. I'd say, sure, I'd love to turn it into a book. And then, of course, the caveat comes. But it has to be 75,000 words. Well, we're taking a 250,000-word manuscript, right? And now you're telling me it has to be 75,000 words. And on a lecture, I can include musical examples, which I can then actively analyze while we listen. In a book, you can't do that. So in reality, it is not a book version of the course. It was a completely rethought piece because I had to decide what the one or two most important points was going to be. I simply could not attack with the breadth that I did this larger course in book form. So, and of course, that's the easiest thing to criticize, and I'll be the first one to do it, is that on one hand, look at everything you left out. And, yeah, I mean, if I go to my grave and find myself in a place opposite of where I'd hoped to be, the first thing I will be told, it's because of everything you've always left out. There's no doubt in my mind that is my mortal sin. But if we're afraid of leaving things out, are we not going to make the statements that need to be said? You know, I think the whole point of education, it certainly is true with my education and as a professor for so many years, what I always tried to give the kids, you give them information, but what you're really giving them are the skills to seek it out on their own. You're giving them a context so that when they read something, they have somewhere to put it in their mind. They have somewhere to frame it against what they already know. And that's the point of a book like this, too. It's not to be all-encompassing. It's simply to create a good frame, a frame that allows someone to start thinking contextually. That's the point, really.
And that's the beauty. I mean, studying in the late 20th century, who knew that, you know, tablets and the internet would make such a, you know, difference in how we communicate and how we absorb entertainment and knowledge and learning, all these sort of things. So now it's sort of amazing that, one, there's this book, but two, there is this whole sort of course that one can sort of delve into and explore many more topics that you've explored in greater detail.
And the beauty of something like this, too, is you read the book, and it might mention a piece of music by Josquin des Prez, a wonderful, extraordinary 15th-century composer. Or it might, you know, I'm talking about a piece of music that might be semi-obscure. You go on YouTube, and you find a performance of it. I mean, it's an amazing thing. We have access now to pretty much everything. Of course, the only problem with total access is we can't ever be really sure that what we're reading has the imprimatur of truth to it and or facts behind it. And that's, you know, that's the great challenge of our info glut now is, what's worth our time and what's not? In the old days, at least in a published book, not that everything in books is true either, God no. But at least if something had survived the process of editing and publication, you knew that it had a very good chance of being correct, at least up to a point. But now the stuff that's up on the web, oh, my goodness. So on one hand, it's a good thing. On the other hand, user beware.
It's so nice to talk to you. We are delighted about how to listen to great music and look forward to much, much more.
Me too. Thank you so much.